Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Good morning and Happy New Year to you. Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show. We all had a bit of a break. Thank you for continuing to listen. In the meantime, I was getting emails during the time that we had some R&R in the past week or so from people saying, you said something on the show today I'd like to talk about it. And I'm thinking, when did I say that? And then I realize this is from some earlier shows that we aired. So welcome back. It's great to have you back. It's great to be back. Cyrus, you look well. You look hale and hearty, my friend.
Hey, I'm feeling pretty well. You look pretty good yourself.
Thank you.
Yeah, Happy New Year. Merry Christmas.
Happy New Year. Let's hope and pray that it's a better New Year, a better year than it was last year.
It's a pretty low watermark.
Lots to be grateful for, and we'll talk about all sorts of things, including what's on your mind. My number is 888-914-9149. This is a full-service show. You're welcome to call, and we'll talk about whatever's on your mind. 888-914-9149. Of course, though, the big story, among many big stories that have unfolded in the last several days, is the death of Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI. And let's go back in time to April 19th, 2005, when the whole world heard these words coming from a cardinal who had just come out of the conclave, and this is what he announced to the world.
Dear brothers and sisters, annuncio vobis gaudium magnum. Habemus Papam.
We have a Pope. I announce to you tidings of great joy. We have a Pope. And now he'll identify him.
Eminentissimum ac reverendissimum Dominum.
The most eminent Dominum and reverend.
Josephum. Sancte Romanae Ecclesiae Cardinalem
Cardinal
Ratzinger.
Of the Holy Catholic Church, Ratzinger. And the crowd went wild. It was a great day. I remember where I was, Cyrus. Do you remember where you were and what you were doing when this was announced?
No.
It's one of those things for me. Yeah, I really do. So a friend of mine and I, buddy of mine for many years, he and I, we knew, of course, that the announcement was going to be made. Everybody knew, because the conclave, the smokestack emanated white smoke, which is the sign that an election was successfully conducted, and they had a new pope. If it's black smoke, then they know the people outside, they see the smoke come through the chimney. If it's black, they know, okay, they voted and it was inconclusive. So when you see the white smoke, then you know that it's conclusive. These are archaic customs, but they're, you know, there's something quite beautiful and interesting about them. So everybody was waiting, and when we found out that the vote had been conclusive, this, of course, is in the immediate aftermath of the death of Pope John Paul II of blessed memory, and there was a lot of speculation about who it would be. A little interesting tidbit. This is one of the reasons, and I'll come back to where I was when this happened. I had been asked by I think it was LifeSight or Crosswalk, one of those, at that time at least, a large faith-based internet website that hosted articles and essays by different people. And they got in touch with me and asked if I would like to be a cardinal in an upcoming virtual conclave. So they invited laymen and women and some priests and other folk to participate in this sort of faux conclave where we would write our choice for who we would want to be elected pope to follow Pope John Paul II. And I was, as I recall, one of maybe a dozen people, perhaps. And I think I was the only one who voted for Pope Benedict. Maybe one or two other ones did. So Cardinal Ratzinger at the time. And that in itself seemed a bit controversial because a lot of people had this erroneous notion that Cardinal Ratzinger was this ferocious. Yeah, I always had to roll my eyes when I would see things like, you know, God's Rottweiler or the Panzer Cardinal and just nonsense like that. He was never anything like that. He was a very cultured, refined, mild-mannered, gentle soul. He was among the greatest, if not perhaps the greatest theologian that the church has produced in the last, say, 60 years or so. And his pedigree can demonstrate his prowess on the theological playing field. But in any case, I voted for Cardinal Ratzinger. And I was hoping and praying that he would be elected because even then, this is in 2005, there were lots of rumors swirling around. Well, what if we get a liberal pope? Or what if we get a pope who will, you know, there are all kinds of speculations. And I thought personally, not only did I have such high regard for Pope Benedict or at the time Cardinal Ratzinger's intellectual prowess and all the beautiful things about what I had seen in his writings over the years, but also I saw, and I think this is true, I mean, you can look back and see a continuity that extended forward from the pontificate of Pope John Paul II into the pontificate of Pope Benedict XVI, who, as you know, died in the last couple of days. He was 95 years old. So he died of old age. And now, of course, there's not going to be a conclave. There's not going to be an election of a new pope because there is a pope already. It was strange for all of us back in 2013 when Pope Benedict XVI resigned his office. And yes, I'm well aware of the controversy that exists in some circles about did he really resign or did he only resign the ministry? And in the distinctions between certain Latin words, munus, for example. And we won't enter into those polemics. But in any case, when he resigned, the conclave that was called in the immediate aftermath of his resignation, his abdication, elected Pope Francis. So this is why when I share with you the news, for example, that only two countries are going to be sending official delegations to the funeral for Pope Benedict, which is coming up. When I say Pope Benedict, by the way, please understand, Pope Emeritus Benedict, don't read anything more into that. It's the title that he himself chose. And there's a controversy over that. Like, should we allow that? Should we allow a former pope who abdicates, should it be allowed that he can have that title because it might lead to people thinking maybe he's still the pope, things of that nature. So we won't enter into those polemics either. But when I tell you that only two countries, Italy and Germany, are going to send an official government delegation to the funeral for Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI, don't be alarmed by that. And I would say don't be offended by that. It would be nice if other countries paid tribute to him in that way, but this is different, and it's unusual, let's say, to put it lightly, because for the last 600 years and change, no pope has resigned. About 600 years ago, Pope Celestine did resign, and there have been one or two over the ages before him, but this was uncharted territory when Pope Benedict XVI resigned. One thing to take note of, by the way, this is just a slight digression. And among the various arguments that are happening, especially on the internet, with regard to Pope Benedict's resignation, has to do with Latin. And he didn't use the right Latin, or he didn't use the Latin term, or he didn't say it the right. Keep in mind that Cardinal Ratzinger, Pope Benedict XVI, he was a true Latinist. He spoke many modern languages freely. He could sit down with you and converse in, of course, his native German. He could speak freely and fluently in English and French and Italian and Spanish, some say even Portuguese, perhaps. So he was a polyglot, and he had spent so much time in academia that he was eminently, if you'll excuse the pun, eminently comfortable in these various modern languages. He was also completely fluent and literate in Greek and Latin, maybe more so Latin, and even Hebrew. He was a scholar's scholar. He was a preeminent figure in the world of theology. And so for him to compose a letter of abdication in what some, who by the way, don't really know Latin in some cases, and yet they presume to say, well, his Latin was rather poor and he didn't really. I don't think so. His Latin was polished and refined and something that he had a facility for many, many years. So back to where I was saying that I knew right where I was and what I was doing when the announcement came that you just heard. And this again was in April of 2005, April the 19th. Buddy of mine, we knew that this was going to happen. We knew the announcement would take place, and it occurred right around lunchtime, which was, let's say, 12 to 1 o'clock, you know, in that, right around that time. So we went to a local Italian restaurant or whatever it was, and we sat down in front of the TV, and we had our lunch, and we watched Cardinal Ratzinger come out as Pope Benedict XVI, and everybody went wild, and there were some people who weren't happy about it. I was overjoyed by it. And I thought, okay, great. This is good, because there will be the kind of continuity that you would expect and that we did see from Pope John Paul II's pontificate extending into that of Pope Benedict XVI. So it was one, for me, it was an electrifying moment. It was a moment of encouragement. And so as I look back on his 9 years in the papacy, was it that many? I'm trying to think. How many years was it? It was 8 or 9, because he abdicated in 2013. So it was just shy of 8 years, just shy of 8. And so, of course, we know history since that time. But a few more things audio-wise before we take our break, and we'll be getting to your phone calls as well. This, of course, is the big news amidst a number of stories that are big news right now. Here's the announcement of Pope Benedict's death that was given by Matteo Bruni. He is a spokesman at the Vatican, and here's how he announced the passing of Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI.
With sorrow, we inform you that the Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI passed away today, this morning, at 9:34 in the Mater Ecclesiae Monastery in the Vatican.
Yeah, so that's where he had been tended to in his final hours. We have a bit of audio, I think, number 3, Cyrus, with regard to Pope Benedict's body lying in state as it is right now. And then also, before we go to the break, why don't we also talk a little bit about the video or the audio for the funeral arrangements. And then maybe when we return, we'll take a look or a listen to a couple of other clips.
All right, so this is that Pope Benedict will be lying in a state.
Lying in state, okay.
From the morning of Monday, the body of the Pope Emeritus will be in the Basilica of St. Peter's, where the faithful can go with their prayers for a last meeting with the Pope Emeritus to greet him and to say goodbye.
Now, of course, that's figurative language. The Pope is no longer there. His body is there, and it's entirely appropriate and certainly customary for people to pay their respects by viewing the remains of the Pope, but you understand he's speaking figuratively because Pope Benedict XVI has gone on to his eternal reward, Pope Emeritus. Lastly, I think we've got, what do we have next? 5 or 6?
Yeah, let's do 4. One? This is a little bit about the funeral on Thursday.
Okay.
And I have a feeling there'll be some announcements from Relevant Radio later today. Yes. About exactly how we're covering that.
Right.
The funerals will be on Thursday this coming week, Thursday the 5th of January, at 9:30 on St. Peter's Square, and they will be presided over by Pope Francis.
Okay. And we have a short audio that we can play before we go to the break. Actually, we've got a little more time than I thought we did. So this is Pope Benedict XVI himself in 2008. So he had been elected Pope a little less than 3 years before this, and he's making a few remarks about the future and about hope and encouragement in the midst of difficulties.
I was deeply grateful for the understanding, support, and prayers of so many of you, not only here in Rome, but all throughout the world. The decision I have made after much prayer is the fruit of a serene trust in God's will and the deep love of Christ's Church. I will continue to accompany the Church with my prayers, and I ask each of you to pray for me and for the new Pope.
Okay, I think we got our audios mixed up there, because this is in the aftermath of his abdication. But if we're able to find the one that I was thinking that we would play, sometimes these things get mixed up, but that's okay. We'll come back to that. In the meantime, though, the number again, 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. That's the number to call if you want to be on the air. We'll break a little bit early, and then we'll come straight to your phone calls on the other side of this quick timeout. You're listening to The Patrick Madrid Show live in the new year. Ready, steady, go. I'll be right back.
Hope for the future is very much a part of the American character. And the Christian virtue of hope has also marked and continues to mark the life of the Catholic community in this country.
Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code PATRICK for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find out more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. Yeah. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Yeah. Relevant Radio.
Oh, yeah, that's right, 888-914-9149. Let's get to the phones. Abraham in Chicago, thank you for listening, sir. Welcome.
Hi. I was just wondering, so I was talking to a friend of mine, and his biggest problem with the church seemed to be the various instances of Catholics, committing crimes or atrocities. His example was during Nazi Germany, some bishops supported the church, and my response...
Supported the church or supported the Third Reich?
Supported Hitler and stuff. Okay. My response was that the church itself didn't support it. Those were just individuals. I don't know what... How? Because that seems to be like the bulk of his problem with it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how to resolve that. I don't know if you would have some suggestions. I wanted to hear what you wanted to say.
You have a few. I think number one, we should always acknowledge that reality. It's a painful reality, but it's true, and we don't do anybody any help if we're denying that these things happen. I do believe that we have to keep a sense of perspective, though, because often these evil actions can be exaggerated, or it can be exaggerated to the point where people think that everybody is doing evil things, and that, of course, is not true. But I think the first thing to do is just acknowledge it and say, yeah, you're right. It is one of those mysteries of the church. Jesus, for example, handpicked 12 men to be his inner circle, his 12 apostles, and even they experienced this kind of thing. Judas, for example, betrayed the Lord and committed suicide as a result of it. Jesus said, you know, a devil has entered him. He called him a devil, in fact, in John chapter 6. And yet Jesus himself chose him. And that, to me, that's a mystery. Why did Jesus do that? Why did he choose Simon Peter, who turned out to be a great man? He certainly wasn't great in many respects before his deep conversion. He was petulant and brash and hasty and a coward. He, of course, denied knowing the Lord 3 times, as you know. So if we look at the microcosm of the 12 apostles, we can see this problem that your friend is identifying at the very beginning. It's already there. Yeah. They're bickering and fighting, and we're not told what other kinds of problems the apostles may have had. I mean, we could only speculate, but we do know that they had problems. There were rivalries and resentments, and of course, the big things that I just mentioned with Judas and Simon Peter. So my point here is, if you start there, you could turn it back around and say, well, notice that this is how the church always seems to be. You've got the good and the bad and everybody in the middle all mixed in together. And look at it this way. Here we are 2,000 years later, give or take, and the Catholic Church is still here in spite of bad popes and bad lay people and bad priests and bad bishops and in spite of holy popes and holy priests and lay people and bishops and religious sisters. And we're, the church is still here, not because of the members being good, bad, or indifferent. We're here because Jesus established this church. And he's the one who is keeping that church in existence. So when we look at the scandal of bad Catholics, the scandal of priests or bishops or whoever, lay people leading double lives, you know, and later on you find out, oh my gosh, he sure wasn't what I thought he was. Or you see in history moments where people like bishops, for example, were collaborating with or sympathetic to groups that we know are evil, like the Nazis, for example. And keep in mind, it's always easier to look back on a situation as it is for us now, all these years later, after World War II, and make judgments on the basis of what we know, as opposed to the things that may not have been quite as clear to people in those days. We can still judge them and say they were wrong about these things. And I don't mean to suggest that, well, maybe it was okay to support Hitler, because obviously it wasn't. But my point is this. Even those things, they don't diminish the truth of the gospel. They don't diminish the truth of the church that Christ established. It just means, like over and over again throughout the last 2,000 years, some people get it wrong and some people do bad things. And so to put a kind of a period on the sentence, and then I'll see what you think, Abraham. For me, this is a great sign of encouragement, because it means that the church, if it had merely been a collection of frail, in some cases corrupt and sinful human beings, the church wouldn't have made it. We would have destroyed it ourselves many times over the years. And look, it's still here. That, to me, is one of the proofs or evidences that the Catholic Church is sustained by her head, and that is Jesus Christ. And if it weren't for him, the Catholic Church would never have made it. And yet it's here. So I point to that as an example of how, in the midst of all this other counterintuitive stuff, we can still take hope and realize that it's Jesus who's guarding his church, even if individual members are corrupt and evil.
Yeah. No, yeah, that makes sense. I don't know what, because I tried to explain it to him, mm-hmm. and he just, I don't know, I feel like it didn't click.
It probably didn't. And you know what? I wouldn't lose any sleep over that. So you, this is your friend, or how are you? How do you know this person? He's a relative or a friend?
Well, he's a friend.
Okay. Like a so classic. Let's put it this way. He's, you know, he's got a difficulty, a block of some sort that's preventing him from being able to go beyond this. You did your part. And maybe there's more for you to do, but don't lose any sleep over it. You don't have to close the sale. So maybe 6 months or a year from now or 10 years from now, somebody else will push things a little further. And who knows, maybe when the time is right, the Holy Spirit will have a place there in his heart, and he can move beyond this obstacle. But for you, I wouldn't worry about it. You did what you could. You said what you could. That's all the Lord is asking of you. You know, if there's more that you can say, great. But you don't have to close the sale.
Okay. And just a quick, just another quick thing. Mm-hmm. What's the like? I know that some things a Catholic has to believe, and then there's a lot that is not explicitly demanded by the church, but mm-hmm. you still are able to or should believe it. And what's the difference between the two? And I don't know, what's the line?
Okay. First, I'd like to recommend a book that will give you that in black and white. It'll spell it out very clearly. In fact, I might be able to quote it for you here. But it's a book called Fundamentals of Catholic Dogma. I have a copy right here in my hand. And it is a compendium of the church's teachings. And it also gives the different degrees of certitude when it comes to, you know, what is it that we are obliged to believe? And at the very center, or the foundation, I guess you would say, is what are called de fide doctrines. De fide, meaning of the faith in Latin, means that this is divine revelation as revealed to us in the Holy Bible and by Jesus and the apostles. And these are things that must be believed. If you're going to be a Catholic, they are matters of faith, and it's required to believe them. So that would include the divinity of Jesus, the Trinity, one God and three persons. It would include the real presence of Christ in the Holy Eucharist, the sacraments, the four last things, death, judgment, heaven, and hell, the reality of the communion of saints, the preeminence of the Blessed Virgin Mary in the order of creation, things like that. Those are defined dogmas in many cases. Most of them are defined dogmas. And so these are the things that we must believe. And if somebody were to say, well, I'm a Catholic, but I don't believe that, that would be flirting with the sin of heresy, because to publicly espouse something that is contrary to the Church's teaching would involve heresy. But it doesn't mean that you have to necessarily completely understand every nuance of these doctrines. There are plenty of things that are true, like the divinity of Jesus. How is it that this little baby in the manger is actually God? You know, how do you understand that? We can understand it up to a point, and we try to understand it as deeply as we can, but these are profound truths that have been revealed to us, and God doesn't expect us to have a comprehensive encyclopedic understanding of every one of them or even any of them, but we believe through faith because they have been revealed to us by God himself. Now, okay. Short of that, there may be things that have never been formally defined. Take, for example, the fate of unbaptized babies. So below the age of reason, they haven't been baptized, and we know that baptism is necessary for salvation, but what about them? They didn't commit any sins. They don't have sanctifying grace in their soul because they didn't have baptism. Where do they go? Well, there have been various opinions, and maybe the one that's most commonly known nowadays is the opinion of limbo, which is a theological opinion that has enjoyed great weight and prestige in many circles. But even that is not something that the Church says with certitude. Rather, the Church, especially more recently, says that we should trust and hope in the mercy of the Lord, that in some way that hasn't been revealed to us, that these children will receive the benefit of sanctifying grace and be able to go to heaven. But there the Church says, but we just don't know for sure because it hasn't been revealed to us. So in matters like that, the Church often, you know, will say there is latitude here to hold a various opinion. But on those things that are de fide, we are obliged to believe them and assent to them. And this book that I mentioned a minute ago, Abraham, is called Fundamentals of Catholic Dogma. Ludwig Ott, O-T-T, is the author and editor. And that book has a much lengthier explanation. It gives various gradations of certitude. So if you really want to dig deeper, I'd go to that book.
Okay.
And I hope that's helpful. Happy New Year. 888-914-9149. How about Ginny now in Bryan, Texas? Good morning, Ginny.
Good morning, Patrick.
Yes, ma'am.
I have a question about Sunday. I was listening to a priest on the radio, and he said that Jesus has suffered the same as we, like thirst, hunger, sorrow, suffering. And then he said fear. And I thought, that doesn't make sense, because he's God. He knows everything.
Mm-hmm. Well,
how could
it
he
is
have
true.
Fear?
It is true, of course, that he is God, but he's also man. So in his human nature, which in the incarnation, the Lord, the second person of the Trinity, united to his divinity. So he took to himself a perfect human nature. So that means Jesus has a perfect, he's got the body, the human body. He's got a soul. He's got emotions. He's got all those things that are proper to a human nature. He has all of those things. He's not missing anything. He's a divine person, so he's the subject of this nature. Well, hear me out. Hear me out.
Okay.
Yeah, hear me out. So he's the divine person, but he has a human nature. Now, it's difficult for us to try to imagine what this is like. Obviously, there's nothing we can point to in creation that is like this, so we do the best we can. But what this means, therefore, Jenny, is that whatever normal human emotions that Jesus, that any human being would have. Jesus did have those. So he did experience fear. For example, in the Garden of Gethsemane, he was afraid of what he knew was coming. And this is why he asked the Father, "Father, if it be possible for this cup to pass from me, but not my will, but thine be done." He was sweating blood. He was so fearful of what was coming, and that is, of course, the essence of his agony in the garden. He experienced sorrow. Take the death of his friend Lazarus, and he raised him from the dead, of course. So those emotions that are normal and proper to human beings, Jesus did have them. And take another angle here. Jesus being God, of course, he still fasted for 40 days. He went into the desert and he mastered his bodily appetite for food. I'm sure he had mastered it in any case, but he did without food for 40 days, and he had all the natural human cravings for food that you would have or that I would have. So perhaps it's in this sense that the priest, I didn't hear what he said, but perhaps it's in that sense that he was talking about how Jesus suffered. Does that make sense, Jenny?
It does, but he could suffer and have sorrow in the garden. But the Lord has told us from the beginning of the Old Testament to the end, do not fear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't think he feared. I think he suffered. He sorrowed.
Well, what was he sorrowing over? He was sorrowing over what was coming.
Right.
And if he didn't fear, in a true human sense, then there would be no reason for him to ask the Father to let this pass from him.
Okay. Well, you know? That makes sense. Mm-hmm. I still think it's suffering and sorrow.
Well, it certainly is that. I don't mean to say it's not, but we shouldn't be afraid to say that the Lord experienced fear. Because if you're a normal human being and you know what is about to happen to you as he did, you wouldn't be a normal human being if you didn't experience fear.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Well, I know that your heart's in the right place and that you love the Lord and you want to safeguard his majesty. I understand it completely.
Okay. Well, thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Nice chatting with you and Happy New Year to you. Let's go now to Northern Virginia and talk to Janet. Hi, Janet.
Hi, Patrick. I have a quick question. Okay. I was with my 20-year-old son yesterday, and I mentioned to him that my niece on my husband's side is now engaged to a transgender. She's really a girl, but mm-hmm. everyone's basically, you know, saying, "Oh no, this is a boy." And my niece, it's the whole thing, right? So anyway, I mentioned to my son, I said, you know, we will not be able to attend the wedding because, you know, it's contrary to, you know, God's law, whatever. Mm-hmm. He's like, well, how is it that we were able to go to all the other weddings of cousins, most of whom got married, like, you know, on mountains and anywhere other than in a Catholic church, even though they were, quote, you know, well, a couple of them getting supposedly Catholic marriages. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so he's trying to understand, well, where does it say that? How, what, you know, mm-hmm. and I want to understand. So mm-hmm. just thought, well, let me get back to you on that. So here I am asking you.
Well, maybe one way to put it, I can understand your consternation, Janet. One way that you could say it would be, ain't no mountain high enough to have. I thought you'd like that. That song's going to be in my head for the rest of the day. Ain't no mountain high enough to make it an actual marriage. Because whether they get married on the golf course or on top of Mount Everest or on the moon or in a church, two women cannot be married. Now, legally, the state says, oh, yeah, they're married, but that's okay. That's what the state says. The state also says it's okay to abort unborn babies and things like that. So we can recognize that the state will recognize that as a wedding. But in the eyes of God, it's not a marriage. And Jesus speaks to that issue. You said, well, where is it written? go to Matthew chapter 19, start reading in verse 1 to get context. And as you know, Jesus says, in the beginning, God made them male and female. And this is why a man leaves his parents, his family, and he clings to his wife, and the two become one flesh. And what God has joined together, let no man put asunder. So here Jesus is giving the paradigm of the institution of marriage and human sexuality and all of the above. And he's really clear. Mm-hmm. It's one man and one woman. And anything that's not that is not valid. Now that's from, you know, looking at it from a theological perspective. Look at it from a natural law perspective. And in this case, the natural law has to do with what are the purposes or ends of things? What are they made for? Like the end or the goal of your eye is to see. The end or the goal, the purpose is of your ear is to hear. Now, if you extend this and take a look at the human reproductive system, think about this. You have a complete digestive system, so do I. You have a complete circulatory system, you have a complete nervous system, you have a complete, all the different various bodily systems that we have physiologically, they're all complete under themselves with the exception of one, and that is your reproductive system. You basically, as a woman, have half of a reproductive system. I have the other half of the reproductive system. Now, just from a natural law standpoint, you can see that the goal of the two people uniting in this manner is to produce offspring. Doesn't mean it always happens.
Right.
Doesn't even mean it must happen. But even in our bodies, we can see that we are made to be complementary, male and female. And the purpose of that complementarity from a physical standpoint is to produce offspring. Two men can't do it. Two women can't do it. Or any other combination. So even nature itself shows us that the paradigm for marriage and all the things that are associated with marriage is one man and one woman. So back to this.
But why can't, so then he's going to say, okay, all well and good, he understands all that, but why can't we, as, you know, relatives of this niece, like, why, I mean, my kids understand that it's disordered, but
why can't they go celebrate?
Like, why can't we go to the, quote, wedding? Like,
because it's not a wedding. In other words, what the difficulty here, it seems, is they may be thinking, well, if they think they're getting married, isn't that enough? Well, the answer is no, because first of all, a wedding, a marriage, is a public act, and the church and all of us in the church have a vested interest in the success of these two people who are getting married. And when you go to the wedding, it's more than just having champagne and cake. That's nice. But we're really there to show our support and approval of this couple that's getting married. And what it amounts to is, in essence, a lie if you attend a quote-unquote wedding that is not a real wedding. I realize that it's difficult. But go ahead. I'll give you the last word, Jen.
Okay, the last thing. But for all the other weddings that were held in the fields and wherever, was that also not was that something that we should have bowed out of? Because we'll have more of those.
Yeah, those are assuming that they're at least one of the two people is Catholic, and if the Catholic who has the obligation to get married in the Catholic Church, etc., doesn't do it, then it's an invalid wedding. If it's two Protestants or two Hindus or a Buddhist and an atheist, that's a different story. That kind of wedding you can go to. I wish I had more time, Janet. Thank you, though. I'll be right back.
We've been waiting for a long time.
Compelling insights.
Yes, we've been waiting for a long, long time.
Unpredictable conversations.
We've been waiting for a long time.
Encouragement for your day.
We ain't gonna wait no more. We're getting ready to rock and roll.
It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right. Hey, Cyrus, talk about the most... what's the right word for this? Probably the The most tone-deaf decision I've heard of in a long time is Bill Cosby, who's out of prison on a technicality. He's planning to do a comedy tour this year.
Hey, hey, hey.
Who would go to that? And would you want to be seen?
It'll probably be a bunch of people protesting. They'll pay for tickets to protest, and he'll laugh all the way to the bank.
It's just astonishing to me that he thinks, well, I mean, I could be wrong, and maybe there are people who will go out to see him. He's 85, as everybody probably knows. I mean, he did a stint in the Big House for criminal sexual assault, and there's a long and sordid story behind all that. We don't have to get into it, but
It is such a sad story. This is America's dad. I mean, this is, for me, I grew up in an all-white neighborhood. Like, there were no black people at all, and Bill Cosby was that was the first person I became familiar with, at least, you know, from being a kid sitting at home watching TV. He was the first black person that I loved. I loved Bill Cosby. He was hilarious. The show
maybe
was
one
funny.
Of the first
he
ones that you ever really got to know as a person, you know, at least in his persona on TV.
Right. That's exactly
everybody
right.
loved the Huxtable family.
Yep.
It was a great show.
Yeah. What a fall from grace.
Yeah. So anyway, I just thought, in case you were wondering what comedy shows you're going to see this year, that's an option. If I had to guess, I don't think the tour is going to last all that long.
I would put money on that. I'm not a betting man, Patrick, but I'll put money that that's not going to go more than a couple of cities, if any.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't know what the precise legal issues are surrounding him, you know, getting out of prison. I mean, he was convicted and he went to prison for a time. And I don't know what all the niceties are about that. To me, it appears as though it's some legal technicality, but who knows? I'd have to go back and reread it. But the fact is, he's a free man. So he can do this, and it just strikes me as you're not seeing how other people would see this. So it'd be interesting to find out if this is successful or not. I'm going to guess it probably won't be, but just thought you'd want to know. Talk about reinventing yourself.
Trying to. 85. That's kind of old to go on the comedy circuit, too.
Yeah, I don't know how old the older comics are nowadays. Probably not too many of them left. But we'll see. So just something for your good-to-know file. 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Sam now in Athens, Georgia, where it's always automatic for the people. Good morning, Sam.
Good morning. Automatic for the people and go dogs.
So how are you this fine day, Sam, in the new year?
I'm wonderful today, thank the Lord. I have a technical question for you, Patrick.
Okay.
Let's say that two unbaptized people got married, then divorced, then married somebody else, then divorced again. Would the church see them as still married?
It would depend on the circumstances of their first marriage, because that's where, you know, the issue of was that first marriage valid would come into play. And if they had gone through the annulment process to find out whether or not that first marriage was valid, and if the church said, yeah, it was valid, based on all the evidence, we don't see any impediments that would have made it null, then subsequent marriages would have been null. Now, if the church were to determine that that first marriage was null, then it leaves open the question, could that second or third marriage, I forget now how many there were, but then there's a possibility that that second marriage might have been valid, but it might not have. So that too would have to be investigated to see. Could be that none of them were valid. Could mean that the first one was valid and the subsequent ones obviously were not. So it would really depend upon those kinds of variables to know.
Well, let's say if the first one was valid, then if they decided to get back together, would they need to be remarried?
Not in the eyes of the church, but probably in the eyes of the state. So if there was a legal divorce on record, I'm not a lawyer, so I can only speculate, but my assumption is that the state would require quote-unquote remarriage for the purposes of the civil dimension of marriage. Because once a couple's divorced, but, they're no longer married in the eyes of the state. So I think they probably would at least get do that, but the church, strictly speaking, wouldn't require it.
That's interesting. I was just running that through my mind because I would kind of fall into that scenario, but I want to make sure this is hypothetical. I'm not considering any of this.
Right, right. Now, do you mean that for yourself personally or your parents?
Yes, myself personally.
I see. Well, you know, if you're interested, there's a very good book by a canon lawyer. His name is Ed Peters, and it's on this issue of marriage and annulments. And I want to give you the actual title. So Edward Peters is the name of the author. And the name of the book is Annulments and the Catholic Church, Straight Answers to Tough Questions. The reason this is a helpful book for you, Sam, or anybody who's interested in this issue, is because he gets into a lot of related issues like, well, how can we know if the first marriage was valid? What does it mean for a marriage to be valid? What about a second or third marriage? What if one party doesn't want to cooperate, doesn't want to answer the questions, that kind of thing? Does a marriage that's deemed to be invalid, does that somehow render the children from that marriage illegitimate? The answer to that is no. Illegitimacy is a legal issue that's from a, at least in this context, that's the civil aspect of it. But if the two people are married in the eyes of the state and they thought they were married in the eyes of God, turns out later they weren't, it doesn't affect the legitimacy of their children at all. That's a common fear. I don't know that you have that fear, but many people are concerned about that, or they were told that and it's not true. The church does not look at those children from that marriage as illegitimate at all. So it answers questions like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope it's on Audible. The last book you recommended me to read was on Audible, but not ever having used it, really, I got hooked on it and ended up reading 40 books that month. So be careful what you recommend.
Oh, man, you're busy, aren't you? That's really neat.
Yeah.
I have a few of my books on Audible, but I'm going to, as long as we're at this, I'm going to find out. I'm going to look and see if this book is in Audible. And I don't mean, is it inaudible? Because I want you to be able to hear it. But you got it. And not everybody gets the joke. So I just looked in the search bar at Audible for annulments in the Catholic Church, and it does not appear, unfortunately. So I don't think it's available in that context or that format.
Well, maybe I can find somebody to read it to me.
That'd be good. Well, Sam, it's great talking to you. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year and Merry Christmas.
Yes, indeed. Merry Christmas. Can't forget that. Appreciate it, Sam. Thank you. Let's go to Michael now in San Diego. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Patrick. How are you?
I am well, thank you.
Very good. Hey, Patrick, I hope we have a very easy question for you. Can you tell me whether or not if pride is truly a sin or a vice?
Yes, and I always like it when people say it's an easy question. I think that's code for please give me a short answer. So I'll do my best on that. I'll do my best. So, in this sense, pride is both. It's a vice, and by virtue of that, of course, it's a sin. Any vice is a sin. And so in the case of pride, it's denominated as the chief of the deadly sins, the worst of the deadly sins. In a way, it's the root of all the other deadly sins, lust, wrath, okay, gluttony, etc. Pride is kind of the root of all of those. But yes, it's definitely a vice and it's a sin. So it's synonymous, I guess you could say. And anything that is a vice is a sin.
Got it. Thank you. Synonymous, no pun intended, right?
I guess not. Thanks, Michael, and Happy New Year to you. Appreciate it. Let's go to Donna now in Osage Beach, Missouri. How's the surfing there at Osage Beach, Donna? Good waves?
There's no beaches here. I don't know why they call it that. first five Saturdays, devotions.
Yeah.
When I was in Minnesota, the parish there kind of held its own service each Saturday morning, first Saturday. They're not here. And I believe I heard you mention to somebody one time that you can do the vigil mass and it would still be considered that. Is that correct? And how does it work? And I don't even really understand what it's all about.
Well, it extends from Fatima. Our Lady in Fatima in 1917 had explained to Lucia, who was a child at that time, that this was a way to unite oneself with her Immaculate Heart and draw closer to Jesus. And so the devotion is to go to Mass, receive Holy Communion, and say five decades of the Rosary. And there's confession also, doesn't necessarily have to happen on that particular day, but that's a tradition. So Mass, Holy Eucharist, confession, and pray the Rosary on five consecutive first Saturdays. That's the essence of it. So it doesn't have to be at a Mass that is designated as a formal first Saturday Mass. As long as you fulfill those requirements, you have fulfilled the requirements for that devotion. The issue of a vigil Mass is a bit hazy in my mind, and I don't think I know the answer to that question, but I will look it up and get back to you on that, Donna. Thanks for the call. Hour two is about to start right after this, so please stay right there.